Earlier that day, I will be getting my first tattoo.
What?
Yeah.
Jamie, but you're observing Judaism now. You can't. Yeah. They're not going to bury you in a Jewish cemetery.
No,
now.
They're not. They're definitely not.
Jamie, and I've made okay plans. I've made plans.
Yeah, what cemetery?
What?
Could you tell me what cemetery you've made plans with? Which one? Which Jewish cemetery that you definitely know about?
We got a plot reserved at everything. You got a gravestone out in the barn.
Fucking dick. So yeah, and this will be on Christmas. This will be my first Christmas watching A Muppet Christmas Carol with my Gonzo tattoo.
You're getting a Gonzo tattoo? That's great.
I've told you about this tattoo, right?
Probably.
Gonzo as Charles Dickens on the wine that I present arm, or on the arm that I present wine with, also presenting a bottle of wine with a little caption that says, "I am here to tell the story."
This is layers.
Layers deep, there's yes.
Layers. Mm-hmm. You're an onion, Jamie. You have layers.
I am an onion, and I make people cry.
And you make potatoes go bad quickly if you're too close to them.
I love potatoes.
I also love potatoes.
Welcome, everyone, to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle.
Welcome.
It's a podcast about movies and wine, and that is totally fine in that order.
Jamie,
it's
you
fine.
Stepped on my signature welcome. I'm going to have to put that in the outline here so you don't say that.
Your signature welcome comes through because I'm always talking when you say that.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. No. Or you come in earlier right after I say welcome.
Well, I was reaching for my coffee. You were
late.
Empty.
I didn't step on it. You were late. So we're just going to roll with it. Mm. We're going to rock with it, roll with it.
Mm, this is a bad episode. This is not a good start.
For everyone out there.
You guys should switch off. Tune it out. This is not going to be good, everyone.
It's going to be great. We're doing so good. And for those of you out there who don't know shit about movies or wine, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I am Scott. I am the movie guy. And we, James and I, are here to help you.
My name isn't James.
I'm going to cut that part out for sure.
F*** you.
Each episode, we pair a movie I love with a wine that he loves.
We'll tell you and each other why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we don't. Today, we continue with our lighthearted No Bummers miniseries. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I want wine.
We have a special musical parody subtitle for this week, which is White Wine. Flowing through your wine. Today we are talking about Shaun of the Dead.
Which, yes.
Which is just great. 2004's Shaun of the Dead. This is the second feature from Edgar Wright. He's gone on to a great success after this little cult hit with Hot Fuzz, Scott Pilgrim, The World's End, Baby Driver, and then this year's Last Night in Soho. It was written by Wright with the star Simon Pegg. The two of them kind of had their big breakout in the BBC Two cult sitcom Spaced. Pegg plays Shaun, a British slacker fuck-up who in the beginning of the movie gets dumped by his girlfriend Liz right on the eve of a full-blown George Romero-style zombie apocalypse that he is largely oblivious to until it's far too late. Now Shaun and his hetero life mate Ed, played by Nick Frost, the funniest man alive, will fight through the shambling undead horde in order to win back Liz, rescue Shaun's mom, and hunker down at their favorite pub, the Winchester, and wait for all this to blow over. How's that for a slice of fried gold?
Jamie. Yeah, boy!
I'm now following Nick Frost on Instagram, and it's mostly like pictures of him on set and him with his gigantic like COVID beard.
Oh my God.
And him cooking. But his Instagram handle is at Fried Gold, which I'm
perfect.
A huge fan of.
I love that.
So the movie Shaun of the Dead was released by Universal's Focus Features in 2004 to much critical acclaim. It grossed $30 million worldwide on a $5 million budget. And just saying that, it just is insane to me that this movie only cost $5 million.
It's crazy.
It was beloved in the UK and quickly achieved a cult status in the US. As of this recording, it is available to rent wherever you get your VOD movies, or you could like drop $12 and get the 3-pack of this Hot Fuzz and The World's End, which if any of those movies are not on your shelf, like say goodbye to $12 and go ahead and order those things.
And then watch them
in quick succession. And then watch all of them.
Yes.
Jamie, when was the first time you saw Shaun of the Dead?
I don't know, but I bet you do.
No, I don't know, because we didn't see it together.
We didn't?
No, I never saw it in theaters. My first time seeing it was on DVD, and I remember friends of the show, T-Jam and D were trying to get me to go see it with them. And I wasn't a horror person. I wasn't super into zombies. And it was like, oh, a British comedy from people I've never heard of before in a genre that I don't care for. Like, no, thank you. I'm not going to go see that.
Right.
Which is what much of America said. And then, you know, it came out on DVD, which is where the movie really found its life, at least in this country. Yeah. And it's just been on, like, it's a regular rotation kind of movie.
Yeah. I wish I had a specific memory of when I saw this movie first. My guess is that it was your second viewing where you browbeat me into watching it with you again on DVD.
That seems likely. Yeah. Are you a zombie movie person?
No.
Have you seen, well, you've seen this.
Yep.
You've seen, I'm going to guess here. You've seen 28 Days Later.
Yes.
But you have not seen 28 Weeks Later.
Correct.
And you have not seen any of the George Romero dead movies. Night of the Living Dead.
None of them.
Dawn of the Dead. Day of the Dead.
None of the Dead.
Zack Snyder remake of The Dead.
No, sir.
Which came out 2 weeks before this movie did.
Really?
From the same distributor.
That's wild.
Yeah. So the weird thing about this movie, there's a lot of things about this movie. The zombie genre was basically dead when they started working on this. And Wright and Pegg were like, they had bonded over their shared love of the George Romero zombie movies, in particular when they were working together on Spaced, and they had that one, you've seen Spaced.
Yeah.
Okay. There's the episode that opens with Simon Pegg's character, Tim, playing Resident Evil, because Pegg and Edgar Wright were like obsessed with the first Resident Evil game. And it's like a very Edgar Wright Resident Evil scene where he's playing the game. And then suddenly he's like really like there's real zombies in his apartment and he's like, you know, shooting them with the game controller, essentially.
I will say this, as far as my exposure to zombies generally.
Yeah.
Resident Evil is my touchstone.
Right. Because you're a gamer. Right?
I was, anyway, for a time. Yeah. Resident Evil's 1 through Code Veronica. I played multiple times.
How many is that? Is that
four? That's four. Yeah.
And now they're all getting remade because that's what we do in video games now. We just remaster the classics.
I mean, that actually happened years ago. They did Resident Evil 1 on the GameCube.
Yeah, but now they're doing
it
4K
again.
Super next gen. They just keep remaking.
Whatever.
But anyway, so they bonded over their shared love of the Romero zombie movies. So the two of them started working on this script, which they worked on for like 2 years. Then in 2002, Edgar Wright gets word that fucking Danny Boyle, like, you know, like one of the mavericks of like British cinema in the 90s, was working on what turned out to be 28 Days Later. And Wright was like panicked and freaking out like, shit, we're doing a zombie movie and then they're going to come out with this thing. But then what he ended up feeling is that kind of like reawakened everyone's like memory of zombie movies. And then the Zack Snyder, his first feature, the 2004 Dawn of the Dead remake, which is pretty fucking good and easily the best movie Zack Snyder has made. That came out and it was from Universal Studios. Focus Features, who released this movie, is like an imprint of Universal Studios, one of their like indier branches. And yeah, they came out 2 weeks apart. And in the UK, this movie outgrossed the Dawn of the Dead remake.
That's cool.
And now zombies are fucking ubiquitous. The Walking Dead's been on TV for 12 seasons or something insane.
Still on TV?
Oh, yeah.
Jesus Christ.
It's a basic cable juggernaut. People just keep watching.
I recall watching, I think, the first 3 episodes of that show.
Yeah. Well, it has a great pilot.
Yeah.
Like Frank Darabont, who wrote and directed The Shawshank Redemption and The Mist, like he... And now there's a whole lawsuit with that show where Darabont, who left like before the first season was completed because he wasn't happy with the network and they're meddling in the show. He is still involved in a lawsuit with them over back royalties because he like is still, you know, the creator of the show. And and they've made an ass ton of money. I mean, on merchandising alone.
Right.
So anyway, zombies.
Zombies.
But so you're not a zombie guy,
except
in the games.
Except in the games.
Yeah.
And like conceptually, I think zombies are fine. They're fun. And they're like... this like shambling threat. It's the slowness of zombies that really, it's that scary, like this is going to kill me, but I don't have to run as fast as I can.
Yeah.
There's something specific about that.
It's a good metaphor too. Like you can project anything onto zombies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like nothing about why I love this movie is about the zombies. I guess some of the things.
I feel like Sean having zombie Ed chained up in the shed at the end of the movie.
Yes, that's a very, that one resonates with me. I love it.
Yeah.
It's great.
Jamie, if you became a zombie, I would chain you up in my barn
and
out back.
Play Halo with me every now and then.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd probably play Halo with you. And I'd bring you a bottle of Gewurztraminer or whatever.
Dick.
And stab you with it. You like Gewurztraminer.
I don't.
You don't like Avert's demeanor?
I don't like Avert. Generally speaking, there are examples that of good ones, but I don't like that grape generally speaking.
I must confess that because of like my lack of a ear for German, I really had to read this very carefully and phonetically, and I just looked at it and assumed it was Gewürztraminer and just, you know, German, they just...
Nein, it's Grüne Veltliner.
Yeah, it sounds basically the same to me. It's just a series of umlauts and, you know,
there's one stacked consonants. One.
Whatever.
But there are a lot of stacked consonants. Anyway, I fucking love this movie.
It's good.
It's great.
It's a good movie.
It's really good. It's... As we have said on this podcast a number of times, it is a very Jamie movie. It has that mix of tones. It has that like irreverence and comedy that doesn't undercut the seriousness, but that is a good foil for the emotional resonance. Mm-hmm. This movie, I saw it at a time when I was developing a vocabulary for visual arts. Mm. This has become and stayed a touchstone for me.
Yeah.
I love it.
It's real good.
It's super good.
I'm a huge fan. Do you have like a favorite scene? Like, is there something that really jumps to you in this movie, or like a character that really pops for you? My guess is Ed, right? Like you're all in on Nick Frost playing Ed. He's your boy.
I mean,
he's like your spirit animal.
F*** you. Yes, I love the Sean and Nick dynamic.
Yeah,
because they both suck.
Yeah.
But together, they don't suck quite as bad.
No, they suck worse together, but they have such a good time together.
They
just suck to everyone else around.
The scene where they're, after Sean gets broken up with.
Yeah.
And Ed spends forever at the bar trying to get Sean to come around.
Yeah.
And then they go back to their house and they've got their hats on backwards and to the side and they're like DJing.
Yeah.
That's pure elemental joy for me. It's wonderful. That just like you're fucked up with your best friend doing stupid shit.
Right.
I love it.
And then your grown up roommate who's mad at you comes out and screams at you for playing hip hop at 4 a.m. And instead of apologizing, you have to correct him and say, it's not hip hop, it's electro.
I have never experienced a moment like that in my life.
No. No, you have not.
No further questions.
Yeah.
Yeah, that scene, also just the gag where Sean gets hit in the head with the dart and then pulls it out.
And dogs can look up.
That's really great. Just everything about this movie. But yeah, in particular, it's the Sean and Ed dynamic that gets me.
It's kind of the heart of the movie. It's funny because they... Even like, I think it might even be on the title page of the script, but like Wright and Peg in the conception of the movie and then in like selling it to financiers and distributors, they were very clear that it's not a zombie parody. And their pitch was always, it's a zombie rom-com or a zom-rom-com.
Yes.
And despite all of that, like the rom-com element is a little bit sidelined. Like the Sean and Liz dynamic is good, and Kate Ashfield, who plays Liz, is terrific. Yep. And all of that stuff is great, and I totally buy into it. But the real relationship that's like the beating heart of the movie is Sean and Ed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct. It's their romance.
Yeah. It's a bromance for the ages.
It truly is.
Yeah. Can I read you something, actually? Because this so I just finished this new book that came out like 2 weeks ago. It's from Clark Collis, and it's called You've Got Red on You, How Shaun of the Dead Was Brought to Life.
That is a handsome-looking volume.
It's very tasteful. It's got red, shiny, foil, which has all been flaking off, and it basically, like, glued all the pages together when I first got it. But it is an exhaustive, like, oral history, essentially, of the making of the movie.
I mean, it's written down, right? So it's not much of an oral history.
Jamie. It's because he went and spoke to everyone who was involved.
But it's written on the page in words.
All right, Jamie. I'm glad that's the direction you went with a punning on oral, but okay.
It wasn't a pun. It was just being literal.
Anything at all. Anyway, so he talks a lot about the Peg and Frost dynamic. Frost's first job, like ever, as an actor was in Spaced.
Okay.
He was Simon Pegg's buddy and roommate who like worked as a line cook and sold a little bit of weed on the side.
Of course he was a fucking line cook.
Yeah. Peg convinced Edgar Wright that they had written this character Mike in Spaced, who was based on a character that like Nick Frost would do. He was like a bit that he would do, essentially. And he convinced him to bring him into the show, even though he was not at all a trained or professional actor. And he's very, very good and very funny in that show. And then it was like a huge problem to get him cast for this movie because, you know, people had to put down real money to get this thing made. But like, it's just the two of them together that makes it work. But their dynamic is spelled out really nicely in this one little passage from the book that I would like to read to you here. The pair's friendship deepened further after Peg split up with his girlfriend and moved in with Frost. Quote, he had nowhere to stay, so he came to sleep on the floor of my bedroom, says Frost. But I can't bear to see a man on the floor, so we topped and tailed for a bit, and then we ended up just sleeping next to one another for about 8 months. At night, the friends would sit up in bed together, perusing some outsized book, often an atlas, before falling asleep. It was a whirlwind romance, says Peg. We got each other in a way that I hadn't ever with anybody, really. It was amazing. I kind of lamented not being gay because I think we would have made a wonderful married couple. But instead, we just spent all our time together and became great friends. Doesn't that just warm the cockles of your heart there?
It really
does. Doesn't that make you tear up a little bit?
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's joyful.
It's like, I don't know. I don't want to project anything onto anybody, but it kind of sounds like, what if you and I didn't have, you know, toxic competitive element in our friendship?
Yes, correct.
Like, what if you could just be sincerely friends with someone? Oh boy, maybe I'm the problem. Maybe it's me, Jamie.
It's definitely you.
Okay.
No, it's definitely both of us.
What I have always loved about this movie, and I remember it from the first time I watched it, and it's in most of Edgar Wright's movie, is that he is able to pull off this magic trick where this movie should not work at all. And there are like the major pillars and elements of the movie are all at odds with one another and it shouldn't work. And yet it does. And that tension is what makes it special. So it's a zombie comedy, but it's not a zombie parody, right? The zombies are part of the joke and part of the slapstick and the humor, but they're still zombies and they're still dangerous. So we're able to laugh at them, but then they can still be threatening. The threat is real, even when it's funny. The movie is a broad, silly, and at times slapsticky comedy, but it also has a real emotional core that works. I remember the first time I watched this movie and when Sean's mom, Barbara, by the way, spoilers for a 17-year-old movie, everyone, but when Sean's mom, Barbara, who has like finally, you know, succumbed to her zombie bite, when she turns and then Sean is the one who has to kill her, like, not only is Peg fucking great in that, but I just remember like being shocked, like, oh, wow, I didn't think this movie was going to like go for it. I didn't think it was going to be able to pull this off, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it hints at it when Philip, his stepfather, dies.
Yeah.
And that's pretty emotional, too. Yeah.
The great and wonderful Bill Nighy, who is terrific in his handful of scenes in the movie.
He's so great.
He's so good. But yeah, the emotional core works. And the other thing is that it's a Swiss watch. It's super precise and meticulous, where every line of dialogue sets up a payoff later on, and every scene transition is clever and propels the narrative along, and every shot and every cut are exacting and specific. And yet somehow it still feels alive. It's spontaneous. It's not hermetically sealed. You know, like you can have movies where like it's very formal and very particular, and it kind of like, it feels like it can choke the life out of something, especially like a comedy.
Right.
Like this is the opposite of what we talked about recently about Judd Apatow comedies and a lot of like modern American comedies, which are very shaggy and loose. And we just plunk the camera down and people, you know, they'll do the jokes and they'll do the scenes and then maybe they'll riff and improv a little bit. And it's very flat and bland. And this is the opposite of that. But the jokes still work. Like the humor still works.
Bouncy.
It feels bouncy and the characters feel funny, even though like all of these performances, like Wright is all about timing, right? We've talked about this before about when Edgar Wright goes to make a movie, he's got the whole thing in his head ahead of time. He's not a guy who's looking to discover along the way. Not to say that he's opposed to improvisation or variation or, you know, like letting the cast and his crew members make contributions, but like he has the whole thing and a lot of it is about timing and the edit and the rhythm and landing jokes with sound effects and with cuts and with whip pans. And he can do all of that, but you would think that that would be stifling as a performer.
You really would. And what the moment that comes to mind as you're talking about all of this is when the two different survival teams meet each other. Mm-hmm. Yvonne is the name of the woman who Sean is friends with or whatever.
Yvonne is played by Jessica Stevenson, who co-created Spaced with Simon Pegg. But she has a great little scene. Sean!
Well, that moment where they all meet up and it's revealed that Sean's team is going to the Winchester and her team is going somewhere that is probably smart.
Yeah.
They're all lined up and they're just analogs of one another.
Just perfect analogs for one another.
And the joke plays out as they walk past each other and everyone does like sort of a nod to the other one in their particular idiom.
Yeah.
That seems like a scene that you could film that would just be like checking boxes, like, okay, we got the gag.
Yeah.
And then on screen, it just wouldn't play.
Yeah.
Because it's so, that's so specific, but it doesn't. It's fucking hysterical.
It's really funny. That scene is also like, it's probably a joke that plays much better now that like a lot of those people have achieved a lot of fame,
right?
At least in this country. But like the analog for Liz is Yvonne's boyfriend, who is Martin Freeman. Yep. And the analog for Ed is, and the character's not given a name, but it's Matt Lucas. Yeah. The analog for Sean's mom is, I forget the actress's name. She plays Marcia, the landlady in Spaced.
Oh, okay.
So like a lot of familiar faces, a lot of like very fun little winks and nods here. It is crazy to me that the movie works. And in every one of the unofficial trilogy of these Wright, Pegg, Frost movies, this one, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End, they all have that like special magic of precision and meticulousness and jokes that come from clever dialogue and plays on words and transitions and match cuts and whip pans and all this stuff. But they all work in the same way that Sean does. And I'm always amazed by those movies. Wright can be such a, I don't want to say he's a formalist because that sounds like I'm saying that he's like some kind of like high artist, but like he's, especially for a comedy director, he's very, very specific about his style and his aesthetic and his rhythm. And those things are recurring, you know, themes and motifs throughout.
Right.
The way that he uses dialogue and foreshadowing and match cuts and things to, It is propulsive. They're a little transit. A scene never just ends on a cut, right?
Right.
It ends on something that moves you into the next scene.
And there's every time a sound effect that brings you there too.
There's often a sound effect, or there's a visual cue. One of my favorites is right when Liz dumps Sean. We never actually hear her say the words, right? They have that scene where like Sean failed to make plans to get a dinner reservation, right, and he runs over to her place and he gives her the flowers, which were obviously for his mom.
Right.
And she says, if I don't, you know, make a change, I'm going to end up in that bar like one of those sad old fuckers. And he's like, make a change. And then on that shot, close up on Sean, when he asks her, what do you mean make a change? Her apartment building's front door, which is like a glass clear frame door, closes, cutting the frame. And as it's cutting the, like, and we're in the apartment, right?
Yeah.
So they like do a optical or a digital effect where it cuts across that frame. And as it's doing it, Sean goes from a close-up to a medium shot. That's a recurring image of Sean standing framed in like the glass door of her apartment building. But now this time he's standing out in the rain with the flowers and he's dejected. Like, we don't need to see the scene of her breaking up with him.
Nope.
We just know that like what she's thinking. And then it's a transition that speeds the movie along, gets us into the next scene, and it's a joke. And like that's the crazy thing about Edgar Wright. And we'll have to share it on social media, but Tony Joe, who's one of the great like video essayists and film video essayists of at least, you know, the YouTube era, the guy of the Every Frame of Painting channel, he has a great video about Edgar Wright and visual comedy, and that there is nothing in the tool bag of a filmmaker's arsenal that Edgar Wright will not use to get a joke.
That is fair.
Anything can be a joke. A transition can be a joke. A cut can be a joke. Even silly things like, I have it written down here, it's fucking pretentious, but the way Wright uses action movie language to depict the like mundane and quotidian of everyday life. Like,
what do you mean by that?
Well, so all right. So Sean is getting ready for work early on in the movie. And we have like quick zooms, like a quick shot of Sean brushing his teeth while the camera zooms in on his mouth. And there's a whoosh.
I see what you're,
And then a quick zoom and a whoosh of him like tying his tie. And then the whip pans of him grabbing his keys and then rushing out the door. Like all of this, like Michael Bay and John Woo and like 80s and 90s Hong Kong cinema, and like using action language and like kinetic editing and frenetic pacing to just tell you about the ordinary. And in this movie in particular, it really works because like Sean goes from being an ordinary dude who's bored with his life to being like an action hero by the end of it. But then he does it again in Hot Fuzz, and in Hot Fuzz, they invert it where like Sergeant Nicholas Angel is the Michael Bay movie, like action cop hero in the beginning. And then we see like all of his great accomplishments and his heroics. And then when he goes to the little boring village, we're still getting that like kinetic shit, but now it's showing us how bored he is.
Yep.
Where like he's got to stir his coffee and, you know, there's pans and there's zooms and the whooshes. Yeah, there's nothing that he won't use to get a joke, and nothing is beneath them either. Like the punning, the puns and the foreshadowing, things that should be groaners. So in the scene in the shop where Sean is working, and the end of that scene is Sean saying nothing to panic about, and then cut to like him walking down the street to try and get the flowers, and there's a dude like terrified of something behind him and running along.
Yeah.
Or at the end of the scene you were talking about where Ed is trying to like cheer Sean up, and he's like, look, I'm not gonna say that there's fish in the sea or this or that or a bunch of cliches, but he's like, you know what, it's not the end of the world. Like shit like that that should be groaners and lines that are lazy, even down to the title, which was a major problem for like a lot of people at the distributor and for the studio.
It's the perfect title. What?
But it's also like
it's a high wire act. I get it.
But it's also a pun. It's like it's a little bit lazy. It makes the movie sound like something that it's not, which is very much a parody. And the movie is totally not a zombie parody. It's something true. like a Wayans Brothers scary movie, you know, like it's
hard to divorce my feelings about the movie from like if I hadn't seen the movie.
Yeah.
Transport me back to 2004 before I had seen the movie. I didn't really give the title any thought, but then I saw it and immediately I'm like, oh, this is the title for this movie. There is no other. Obviously, it has to be this.
Yeah,
because it's perfect after you've seen the movie.
What really popped for me this time is that everyone's reaction to the zombie apocalypse is so different and also believable. And it was just something that never like occurred to me before. Like Sean is in shock for much of the first like half of the movie, like after the zombie apocalypse begins. He's kind of numb to it, like especially after when Mary, the first zombie who like comes into their backyard.
Yeah,
he's just like in shock and kind of numb to it. And, you know, he gets out of that. But his initial response is shock.
Shock?
After
I just think he has no context for it because he's been changing the channel the whole time. He has no idea what's happening.
No, I don't mean that. I mean after. So like after the zombie apocalypse begins,
right?
Sean, I guess it's not really the first half of the movie, but like Sean is in shock for a little while, right? Like they have to kill the first. No, this is even before they kill the first zombie. This is after they impale her on the fucking pipe,
and then it's her and the dude with no mouth at the window.
In the script is I think called Hulking Zombie,
which is true.
Yeah, but yeah, he just seems in shock for a little bit, but then Ed's response is like Ed's a total adrenaline junkie. For the entire rest of the movie, like he's into fighting them. He's into throwing records at them. He wants to steal Philip's car and drive around like an asshole.
Yep.
Ed is all about the action and the rush. Barbara, Sean's mom, is in complete denial that it's happening, that her husband has died. Everybody has a different response to it. So like Wright and Peg, their whole thing was that they wanted to make a movie that you could canonically say happened a little bit to the left of Dawn of the Dead. Their idea is that we're going to have basically the same zombies and we're going to have the same types of rules. And while the events of Dawn of the Dead are happening in, you know, Pittsburgh, that this is also happening concurrently in England.
Okay.
It has the same emotional and dramatic stakes as if it were a zombie drama.
Yes.
Right. Like we talked about this with other titles before, but I love a movie I love a comedy where you could take the jokes out and the story still works. And like, I think that's extremely important for any good comedy to work, is that like your fundamental narrative and character relationships have to function for the audience to invest. And then you can have jokes on top of that.
And for this movie, definitely 100% does that. I mean, even the complexity of having David there, who's in love with Liz, but dating her friend, and like the catharsis of that relationship.
Yeah.
And then he gets pulled out of a window and has his insides eaten out of him. Ooh.
So gruesome. That still shocks me.
They're just like reaching in, like they're reaching into a bowl of pudding.
Yeah.
Scooping out his insides. Ugh.
Apparently the actor who played David was very unhappy with doing it that day. The zombies, they reach through a sugar glass window, mm-hmm. like for the stunt. As they're doing the disemboweling, he's in a basically like a, I don't want to call it an armature, but like basically he's standing upright.
Yeah.
And then there's a fake torso that's coming out like perpendicular from yep. his neck. And then that's the thing that they rip over. But like it was sweltering hot and all the, a lot of the ways that they do that stuff is like sometimes they'll use real awful.
Did they use real awful this time?
I believe there's some of it in that scene. And then some of the other stuff is like some of the other zombie gore is using like real awful where they'll go to like a butcher and they'll get tripe and stuff and they'll
liver and kidneys. Yeah. And yeah,
I think some of it is even like that, like some like organ meat and awful that is then like rendered down and blended in to like make the fake blood have like chunkus in it. Like it's super nasty. It's still not as nasty as the nastiest thing in the original Dawn of the Dead, where it's another disemboweling where the zombies have like ripped somebody open and there's just like eight zombies pulling somebody's guts out and eating them. But it's like all actual tripe and awful and grossness, but like under hot set lights, like it was all,
it's all cooking
hot and it had gotten very wrong. And it's just like, ugh, the zombies.
It sounds unpleasant.
Yeah. I don't think I would want to do that.
Not food safe.
You know who did want to do all of this?
Who?
All of the people who played the zombies in this movie. All of the zombies in the movie are extras, and they were effectively unpaid extras. Most of the zombies, though, like the key zombies with like significant screen time, like those are actors who are getting paid. But like all of the background zombies and the teeming masses, those were all Spaced fans. They essentially put out a casting call to like the message boards and whatever for Spaced fans. Like, please come out. Edgar and Simon are making a new movie and it's a zombie film. And we need you guys to, you know, dress up as zombies and get made up and just hang around all day for weeks at a time.
That's fun.
It's fun, but
this, also unpaid labor.
They were paid a pound a day, Jamie, to avoid like labor laws right. about people not getting paid.
Sounds like the $9 a day that I got paid to be a juror.
Yeah. This is the thing that I, coming out of reading this book that I've been struggling with a little bit more, is the making of this movie doesn't sound cool to me.
You hinted off mic that 10 years ago it would have sounded cool.
Yeah, it's the kind of story of like a director up against a budget and a hard line and like, fuck you, we've got to get it made and the art has to happen and fighting with crew members to make it work and the overriding, you know, authority of his vision and everyone's got to get on board with it. And these are the kinds of things that like, especially, you know, male film people, we get super excited about and, you know, fucking... like Werner Herzog and Stanley Kubrick and all these guys who are like, you know, weird and abusive and expecting too yep. much of people and unable to translate it. And it Wright talks about it in the book. By his own admission, he basically failed to get his camera department in particular on board with his vision for the movie. The director of photography, David Dunlop, he and Wright did not get along. It's not good. And Dunlop was a camera operator, and this was his first movie as like first unit director of photography, and he just didn't get it. And he in particular was not on board with Wright's visual style. He denies this, but Wright has said for years that Dunlop said the tracking shots, the two big mirrored tracking shots, the first one before the apocalypse. Yeah, exactly. Sean walking from the flat to go to the shop and then coming all the way back. And then we see it again, except now everybody's zombified and Sean is totally oblivious to it. Right.
Right.
Like signature shots in the movie. Great gags. Lots of humor. Dunlop told Wright, let's not do this. He's like, you're not going to use it. It's too long and it's going to slow the movie down. So like, you're just going to end up cutting it to ribbon. So why are we even shooting it? That was the first thing that they filmed in the movie. It was the first day of production because
wow.
Wright wanted to put his stamp down and be like, hey, I'm young and I've never made a feature before. And I want the crew to know that I know what the fuck I'm doing. So we're going to do something big and complicated on day one. So that was the first thing they shot. And his DP was against it. And they just had these creative issues recurring throughout the movie where he just like he and the camera department didn't understand why Wright needed so much coverage. Like, why do we need to shoot so many increasingly like tight close-ups on everybody for certain scenes? Why do we need all the business with the stuff that we were talking about the way that he uses action language to show the basic and the ordinary, right? Like, why right. do we need so many inserts of grabbing keys and throwing the flowers out and like stuff that is required to tell the whole story, but why do we need so fucking many of them? And it was just they didn't buy into it. And it was a major problem. Right, by his own admission now, we'll say that it was his own failing for like one of the jobs of a director he learned on this project is to sell everybody on the vision. Like it shouldn't just be a job for everyone, like because you're going to have to put in long hours. Everybody should buy into it. And it's the director's job to show them like this is what we're doing.
Yikes.
And he failed. And there was one day when they basically didn't get their shots in because the DP, Wright was like, hey, I need 5 more minutes. Like, we just need to get one more setup or a couple more takes. And they'd already gone into overtime. And the DP and the whole camera department were like, no, like, we have plans. We don't want to do it. It's been a hard shoot. The workday is done. And Edgar Wright, like, went back to his office and destroyed his office. Like by his own admission.
A whiny baby child.
Like a child, like tore all the shelves out of the walls and all this horrible shit. And then the next morning had a meeting with the DP in his office that had not been put back together yet. And so they're just sitting in like the trashed ruins of it. God. And Dunlop was like, I'm going to leave because this is extremely uncomfortable. Thinking more about it. And like, again, like Wright admitted his own failings, but like, you know, he talks about in the book how it was his baby and he was okay working 20 hours a day, like 7 days a week, because yep. He would shoot and he was editing at the same time. So he felt it was okay to ask and expect the same level of dedication from all of his collaborators, which, you know, to me 5 or 10 years ago would have felt like a heroic, like, you know, passion project story. And now it just sounds like abusive labor.
Yes.
It's exploitative.
It doesn't sound that way. It is that way.
Yeah. And that's just like kind of how sets are. You know, we've dabbled a little bit. Our very unpaid short film that we made together was very much a labor of love like that, where mm-hmm.
Everyone needed to be sold on the vision, on the concept, on what we were doing, and everyone just like, I mean, luckily for us, everyone was kind of down to put in those hours.
Oh my god!
Because for whatever reason, they liked us.
Yeah.
You. Well,
they believed
they,
in my
they,
vision.
They liked
Jamie.
You.
They
I don't know
in.
Why.
I don't know why either. But yeah, I don't know, man. Like in particular, the last couple of years, I just feel like
this is not fucking okay. It can't happen anymore. Yeah. Yes, I fully agree. I was gonna do the glib, like I've sarcastic. I've never seen that in my industry bit. But yeah. Fucking, of course I have.
Yeah.
This is the story of top restaurants.
Yeah.
We have a chef slash owner who has a vision, who's working 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, who is a crazy baby man child and throws shit and throws tantrums, and everyone is expected to buy in. And if you don't buy in all the way, then you are fired.
Yeah.
Or just continue to get abused until you buy in.
Yeah.
Some of the worst stages that I've ever had in top kitchens have just like left me sick to my stomach. I actually did a stage at a restaurant that shall remain unnamed in Chicago, where it was policy that if you as a front of house worker dropped something in the dining room or really anywhere, that you would pick that thing up, present it to the chef and apologize, and then go about the rest of your work.
Wow. So it's just about shame. It's yep. just shaming you and making the chef feel like he's a big, strong man.
That is written explicit policy.
Yeah.
You go to chef and you say, chef, I dropped this in this place. I am sorry. And then depending on the mood of the chef, you might get yelled at or you might just get waved off. Not only is that like an intense waste of time and an obstacle to good service, but like, Jesus fucking Christ.
Yeah. It's just maniacal. To be so, and it's we found a lot of these types of parallels talking about the movies and the wines over yep. the previous 26 episodes. But yeah, they're these industries that are, I guess I never thought of it this way, but restaurants, that's a creative field. Like the kitchen, there's a yes. lot of creativity going on, right? But places.
Hold on for a second. You've never thought of restaurants as a creative field?
No.
Even with like my talking about it like it's this grandiose creative thing.
I think that cooking is creative. Cuisine is creative. Your cocktail craftsmanship mixology was clearly creative. But like I thought of those as like siloed things that happened in a larger like industrial space.
Interesting.
But the industry, capital I industry right. of restaurants, like that is just like filmmaking. It's art and commerce coming together.
Yes.
And it seems like there's a lot in both fields where there's mostly male egos that think they can get away with everything and abuse the fuck out of everybody. And not only is it abusive and exploitative, but it's dangerous.
Correct.
Like what we're talking about is on a spectrum with the, by the time this episode comes out, it'll be ancient history, but the fucking tragic shooting accident on the set of Rust, the Alec Baldwin movie. And anybody flaming out about like, oh, Alec Baldwin was holding the gun, he's responsible. Like, no, motherfuckers, he is an executive producer on the film. And that's why he's responsible, because they tried to save money and tried to get everybody on board. We're working together. It's a movie. Come on. We got to save money. We can't afford to hire union crews, and we can't afford to hire a union experienced armorer who's responsible for the actual weapons that we bring on set. Like, and the idea that you just keep going no matter what the hiccups and the hurdles are. Like, yes, financially, maybe you have to keep going, but then financially, it's so much more costly to have a wrongful death suit against your thing. Like, just shut it down.
Yes.
Reassess, figure out what you're doing, and find a way not to abuse people.
I don't have an example quite as egregious as Alec Baldwin shooting somebody in the face.
There's probably not a lot of accidental shootings happening at restaurants.
No.
Except at the Winchester.
Except in the Winchester. But I have worked in a restaurant where, I mean, it's a dangerous job to cook food. The equipment involved produces a huge amount of heat, right?
Like and knives. Don't forget the knives.
Also knives.
Yeah.
And I've seen blood splatter from shucking oysters before, and a chef who just like worked through it because he's a stubborn asshole, but that absolutely should have been taken to the hospital. And I tried to like bodily take him to the hospital, but he was larger than me. Also times where we run out of linens in the restaurant, and a rag, a dry rag, needs to be used to grab a hot pan because those pans have metal handles. They don't have the rubberized grips of like consumer kitchen handles.
Because you're using nice pans.
Right. Yeah. Really good professional pans that are made to last forever. So a rubberized handle would just disintegrate anyway. But you need to have linens on hand. Well, sometimes linen delivery doesn't happen. And I, you know, okay, so I guess chef is forced to grab a hot pan with his hands. And you just operate that way.
Yeah. It's not worth it. It's not.
Just shut it down.
It. Yeah. It's just not worth it.
It's very fucking bad.
Yeah. This is like the only silver lining that I'm trying to see out of the pandemic is that it feels like we are finally again having that conversation about labor in this country. And it feels like unions are maybe getting a little bit of traction and getting a little bit, like specifically traction in the public discourse, right? It feels like there's more vocal support for unions in this country. And like the fucking labor shortage is just because people don't want to go back to shitty jobs where they're abused and taken advantage of.
Like, and where they're not going to make a living wage anyway. It's been heartening to watch some of my colleagues in independent restaurants in Philly really take all this to heart and change the way they do business.
Yeah.
And maybe close 2 days a week, limit hours, raise prices, raise wages, all of those things. Wonderful. But then I turn around and I see my colleagues who are in not independent restaurants owned by evil corporations that continue to just use, abuse people. It's horrible.
Yeah. It's not that reading all of these, like, you know, very warts and all anecdotes about the making of the movie has like turned me against Shaun of the Dead or Edgar Wright. This is just, it's kind of like par for the course, especially in independent film. You know, you push hard, you don't have enough money, you expect people to stay late, and you work the crazy hours, and you cut every corner that you can. Like, and I was very heartened to see him looking back and reflecting on it differently and saying, you know, this was inappropriate. We should not have pushed this hard. And if we needed to get people to stay and work longer, then I needed to do a better job of being a better leader to convince them to do it. But it's part of this whole like conversation I've been having largely with myself since I stopped working about, like thinking about as an employee and as a manager, like what inappropriate like workplace expectations were placed upon me, and then what ones did I place upon the people who worked for me?
Yep. That's been a hard conversation to have with myself as well. It's a real tough one.
It's not good.
But hopefully, fingers crossed, these conversations play out across both industries.
Yeah.
All industries, hopefully.
All.
And some good is achieved from it.
I should hope so.
I would really hope so.
Do you have anything else you want to talk about with the movie?
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
we've been talking about, you know.
We've been talking about the movie
some dire shit in the last few minutes.
I want to talk about something that I mentioned earlier that I really, truly love about this movie, but that I want to sort of explore a little bit. The Simon Pegg, Nick Frost chemistry,
right,
is the thing that we've agreed is one of the linchpins that holds this movie together.
It's a little magic engine that powers a lot of it.
And I think that chemistry among actors is palpable and sometimes not quantifiable. So I want to ask you a couple of things.
Okay.
First of all, how would you define on-screen chemistry?
Well, not to be unhelpful, but it is the same as off-screen chemistry between people. No, but like seriously, it's because like you meet a new person, right? And like when sparks fly, whether it's romantic or not, or like you meet somebody and you click with them right away, and like you can talk for hours.
It's like when we met way back in 1997
in computer class. Yep, definitely. But being able to depict that on screen, like that's the thing that people can't control for. Chemistry has to be organic, I think. Like I've only been on a handful of, you know, very, very tiny, no budget sets. And I've been involved in a little bit of casting. And like you're saying, it's unquantifiable. It's ephemeral.
You know it when you see it.
Yeah.
That was not hugely helpful, but I don't know that we can get much deeper than that.
I don't think there's anything else I can say.
It's chemistry. So the next thing is, to what extent do you think it can be manufactured? Like, are there instances do you think where casting happens, there's no real chemistry, and on set there is some way for either the actors or for the director to like make it appear on screen?
Yes, but not while they're filming.
Okay.
It's in the edit. Or it's bits of trickery. Like or you make a different kind of chemistry by alternating takes, you know, where the one actor in one shot is, or in one take is flirty and the other person is uninterested in it. Maybe that's two different takes and they played it different ways. And then you can create something new by having different takes and different tones put together. So that is a way to manufacture it. But like, can the director and the actors create chemistry where there isn't any? Like I don't think so. I can't say that I've ever heard of it. Like it's always about trying to find chemistry in the beginning.
Right. In the casting process.
Well, in the casting process. So like for a lot of movies, and especially, you know, the big expensive Hollywood ones where they have the money for it, once you've cast your lead, then you might do chemistry auditions or chemistry tests where maybe you've cast your lead actor and you have a couple of actresses who might play the romantic interest, a couple of possible actresses. And so you'll have them read together on camera and we'll see, do these two have chemistry together? What kind of chemistry do they have together? Is this actually going to work on screen? And if you get it wrong, like it can be fatal. It can totally sink a movie.
Right.
We just watched recently the latest and in theory lastest Daniel Craig James Bond movie, which I quite liked most of, but this movie makes what I thought was a strangely fatal error of like doubling down on all the things in the previous Bond movie that were terrible. And there's a lot in that previous one that's terrible.
Which are?
Well, among other things pertinent to this conversation is that Daniel Craig and Lea Seydoux, who are both gorgeous and incredibly talented and charismatic actors, she's supposed to be like the love of his life. Like by the end of Spectre, he basically retires and leaves the MI6 00 force. And this movie picks up right where that left off. And the two of them, you know, it's sweeping European vistas and they've fallen in love and they're together. And it changes everything. And they have no romantic chemistry whatsoever, which is crazy because the two of them are like immensely charismatic performers.
Right.
And then Craig has chemistry with everybody else in the movie. Ana de Armas shows up for like one amazing scene and their chemistry is electric. Lashana Lynch, who plays, spoilers, I guess, from the trailer, the like replacement 007 who takes his number after he retires, she shows up. And while there's no sexual chemistry because, you know, Bond is not, it's 2021, baby. Bond can't just fuck him and dump him anymore. And also because none of the other women in the movie are interested in him, which is hilarious. But yeah, like they have terrific chemistry. And then the movie even makes the mistake of reminding us of Vesper Lynd, who Eva Green from Casino Royale, who is like one of the best performances ever in the whole fucking series. And the two of them have amazing romantic chemistry. And then he goes back to poor Madeline. What's her name? It's like, no, I just don't buy this at all. Like,
so, but you ended up still liking that movie.
I like the movie overall,
but that chemistry.
It's a rare Bond movie where he is in love with the woman. You know, it's not just a romance for the next 2 hours. Like, he's in love with her and makes life-changing decisions based on that love. And it just, I don't buy it at all. So like, that emotional through line of the movie doesn't play for me.
Is there an example of a movie where the chemistry deflates what might have otherwise been like a decent flick?
I don't know. I've struggled thinking about this. I will say, I just rewatched it a few weeks ago, the Baz Luhrmann Great Gatsby with Leo.
Which I have not seen.
Oh, man. I remember that movie being kind of like okay and fine and it just not really working for me. And then I rewatched it recently and I fucking hate it. And I think it's terrible. And I think the biggest problem is that the three leads are miscast. Like, Leo is, you can see why he wanted to play Gatsby, but he's the totally wrong energy for that character. And I think I think Carey Mulligan is very, very miscast as Daisy and also is kind of stranded in that part. And fucking Tobey Maguire playing Nick, like, not only are all three of them miscast, but they have no chemistry with each other. The romantic chemistry doesn't work. The friend chemistry doesn't work. And it's just like, for that story, like, those three leads, you need to understand why they would all basically destroy their own lives for these friendships or these romances, you know? And I'm not saying it would have fixed that movie, but it definitely would have buoyed it into something much more watchable.
Right. Yeah, that's another thing. Like, great chemistry can buoy something that is not the best.
Chemistry can make you think that something is better than it actually is.
Right.
I remember I was always baffled by people's love, and, you know, this has changed now, but for the amazing Spider-Man, the first Andrew Garfield Spider-Man movie. And I remember people loving the romance of it. It's Andrew Garfield as Pete Spider-Man and Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy. And I heard from a couple people like, oh, the romance is way better than in the Tobey Maguire, Kirsten Dunst, Sam Raimi Spider-Man movies. And like, look, the Amazing Spider-Man movies are not good, but the thing that works is that Garfield and Stone have off the charts bananas chemistry, which probably helped because they were like dating at the time.
Right.
But like, their chemistry is ridiculous, so much so that there are a number of scenes where the two of them just kind of like awkwardly teenage, like, stare at their shoes, and like, you can tell that they're like super into each other, but they're kind of shy, and like, and the camera just lets it run. They just let it play because the chemistry is so watchable that you don't care that nothing has happened and no one is saying anything of value and the story and the characters aren't going anywhere. You just love watching the two of them together.
You know, what other movie came to mind? Not that it was like buoyed by great chemistry and would have been bad otherwise, but like, all-time favorite character interactions.
Okay.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Val Kilmer and Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah.
The two of them together on screen.
It's a great script and Shane Black is a great director, but like, that chemistry is why everybody loves that movie. Same thing with The Nice Guys. I was just thinking about this last night. Gosling and Russell Crowe are both really good in that movie, but their chemistry together is like terrific oil and water kind of vibes.
Chemistry.
It's
palpable, but not quantifiable.
I mean, it's chemistry. It's your atoms like my atoms, you know, it's
my atoms hate your atoms. Well, Scott,
that's fair. Your atoms are smelly. Mine are sick of your atoms. But yeah, so that's what I have to say about chemistry.
Yeah.
At great length.
So we need to spend a little time talking about this miniseries that you've put together.
Right. It's the end of the world as we know it.
And I want wine.
Yep.
How does Shaun of the Dead fit into it? I mean, obviously, it's a zombie apocalypse movie, but like, the floor is yours.
It's a zombie apocalypse movie, and like, that's one of the, you know, great end of the world scenarios of, I don't know, second half of 20th century entertainment. The zombie apocalypse. You know, for this miniseries, zombie apocalypse is probably the least likely of potential end of the world scenarios. I would rank it just below giant kaiju coming out of the bottom of the ocean.
Just below?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I
see. The undead are never going to rise from their graves, but we don't know what the fuck is down there, Jamie. It's the ocean.
But what about the T-virus of Resident Evil fame?
I don't know, or the rage virus of 28 days later.
Correct.
I mean, but those are not zombies. They're, all right, Resident Evil, I guess those are zombies. Those are like classic slow-moving, shuffling zombies. But yeah, the fast zombies, unacceptable. Those are not zombies. Simon Pegg repeatedly in this book goes on like half-page long rants about how those are not zombies. Zombies need to be slow. If they move fast, they're not zombies, and they change, and then the zombie doesn't work anymore, and he's very much a purist. But anyway, the thing about this movie that really unsettles me about the end of the world is not the zombies. It's not the massive hordes of the undead. It's how for the first act of the movie, Sean, Ed, and seemingly everyone who's featured in the film are totally oblivious to the fact that there are zombies and that they're about in greater and greater numbers. It's on fucking TV all the time.
Yep.
You get that tremendous, I guess there's two of them, but the.
You're talking about him changing channels.
Him changing the channels, and every reporter or music video or game show that he switches to stitches into one sentence that basically explains the zombie apocalypse and that they're rising from the dead and eating people alive.
Good.
It's so good. Yeah. But that's another one. Like, that's another one of those jokes that, like, on paper should not work.
Right.
Like, that's tongue-in-cheek, and it's lame, and it's kind of corny, and the way it plays is just perfect.
Yep.
That was, like, Edgar Wright's big hook. He wanted to honor the Romero movies, and Romero movies, they always had an element of social satire to them. I'm kind of amazed you haven't seen Dawn of the Dead, because it's a movie where the handful of survivors go to a shopping mall and they lock all the doors and they hunker down, and the zombies keep showing up because that's what they did in their old lives. They just keep going to the mall.
Oh my God.
It's like a huge, like, consumer culture takedown.
Wow.
Yeah. You should watch.
We should
watch that. I haven't seen that movie in years, but so yeah, Wright wanted to do, you know, something in that vein that talked about the world. And his principal idea was like, what if the world was ending and no one noticed until it was too late? That feels extremely relevant to me. Oh, Jamie, hang on. I've got a notification on my phone here. Oh, it's about climate change. We're fine. It's okay. Everything's good. Let's go back to recording our self-indulgent podcast about movies and wine.
I'll put gas in my car later.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So yeah, that's it for me, is that we're
living it. Yeah. One of the things that struck me this particular viewing that I hadn't thought about as much before, because we weren't living through a global pandemic.
Stop saying global pandemic.
It's a pandemic. I know.
It bothers me.
It's like
saying
chai tea. I get it. Oh, Scott's giving me a look like he doesn't understand.
No, I understand. I never thought of it that way.
Chai just means tea. It's tea tea.
All right. Anyway. I never say chai tea, but anyway. I do say tai chi sometimes. No, I don't.
I mean, when you're talking about the meditative art of the sword.
No, only when I talk about the directorial debut of Keanu Reeves, Man of Tai Chi, which rules, by the way.
The thing that I was saying, though, is the very end of this movie is another supercut of like going through TV channels and showing how
it's the new normal.
This is the new normal. Yeah. It is a pandemic that has become manageable and even commodified.
Right.
And they're like our game shows about zombies and talk shows with like, I love my zombie husband.
Yeah.
That period on the end of the sentence in 2021, I found to be both hilarious and distressing.
And very distressing. And it's all mirroring stuff that's in the beginning too, right? It's like, it's the new normal, but it's also the same normal. Like after we get the opening scene in the Winchester with kind of setting the stakes of like Liz and Sean, their relationships on the rocks, and Ed and David and Dyer, like kind of in the middle of that essentially. And then we get the title, and then there's that great little, like, it's not even a credit sequence. It's just the title and like a little musical interlude. And we see day to day, like again, like quotidian life in England. And it's guy in a blue vest pushing shopping carts, or, you know, in a mundane, demeaning job.
And then like hipsters nodding their heads coming down an alley.
Right. It's everybody. And then we come into Sean in the apartment, and Sean is, we start on his feet, and he just kind of like shuffles into the room and yawns, and you think maybe he's a zombie. Like, and then he goes to his fucking shitty job that he hates. And then he turns on TV and we see the same game show that is then mirrored later on, except now the game show of people going down the blue, like inflatable slide is zombies trying to fight to get meat. Like,
and they're all chained.
And they're all chained. Nothing has changed. The guy pushing the shopping cart in the beginning is like an old man, and then by the end of it, the one pushing the shopping cart is the Rafe Spall character, the kid who like was giving Sean fucking a hard time at the electronics store. Yeah, nothing changes. We just find new ways to get used to it, compartmentalize it, and ignore it, and also make money from it.
Oh God, I hate it. I hate it so much, Scott.
If
art could imitate life a little bit less. Sometimes
And I would rather life stop imitating art so much, at least during this miniseries. It's okay, Jamie. Don't worry about it, because next time we're only talking about Mad Max Fury Road, and there's nothing resembling reality at all in that movie. Definitely no parallels to our current world. It'll be fine. It'll be okay.
Everything is awesome.
Immortan Joe is...
It's time for the bad reviews game.
Ooh, the bad reviews game. So, Jamie, tell me, what is the deal with the bad reviews game?
So the bad reviews game is the game where Scott has to listen to negative user reviews from the internet about this movie and this wine and decide whether they are about this movie or this wine, all while clinging to his last shreds of sanity. But today we've got a bit of a different game, a whole different game, actually.
Jamie is getting a little, he's feeling like the variety and the experimentation going on in the wife takes game later in the show is maybe overshadowing his game here, and he's trying to compete. He's trying to do something different.
Well, this is now the second time where we've come up against a movie and a wine that have barely any bad reviews.
There's no bad reviews of this wine?
There is one.
All right.
There was one bad review of this wine, and it says, quote, "The one I had tasted like bin juice."
Okay, well, when that review comes up in a few minutes, I'll know that it's the wine. Thank you.
So I took a different tack here. I was entertained looking down the list of international release titles for this movie.
Okay, great.
Because some of them don't translate to Shaun of the Dead. In fact, many of them don't.
I would imagine. Yeah.
Yes.
Very curious. Okay, great.
So I am going to read you the release title and the translation thereof.
Okay.
And you're going to guess what the country of origin is.
All right. Proceed.
So we're going to start easy. L'Alba de Morti Dementi, which translates as Dawn of the Demented Dead.
And I have to guess what country it is?
Yes.
As we have previously established in this episode, I have no ear for accents or languages whatsoever.
Well, that makes this a little bit fun.
I don't know that I can play this game. Can you say that again?
L'Alba de Morti Dementi.
It's a romance language, because Morte is dead. So that's in the ballpark of, is it Spanish?
It is not Spanish. I'll give you this. Morti. M-O-R-T-I, not E.
We're Italian then.
Correct.
Okay.
This is the Italian release.
I might be better at this if I could read them.
Possibly.
I might recognize the writing, but anyway. So this is the Italian release. And it's what is it? The Demented?
Dawn of the Demented Dead.
Okay. Cool.
Next up. Zombies Party, Una Nuit de Mort.
Zombies Party, Una Nuit de Mort.
Yes.
That sounds en français.
That is Portuguese.
Portuguese.
Yes. It translates as Zombies Party, A Night of Death.
It's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
It's a struggle, man. You getting the international titles to work. Like, this is a movie that is so, not just English language, but like English, that it's there's some stuff that doesn't translate to this country.
I would imagine, yeah, it would be difficult for foreign language viewers. It's difficult enough for a United States perspective.
Yeah. Edgar talks in the book that on Shaun, it was the only time where he was ever involved in the translation for like dubbing or subtitling for an international audience. And he spent a day with these guys doing the German subs and dubs for Shaun of the Dead. And it was like the most exhausting day. And he's never done it since then. But the one thing that he had a major issue with was that during the fucking brilliant Don't Stop Me Now number, where they're dancing to the Queen song and hitting John the publican or publican. It's what they call people who run pubs.
Yes.
Publican, which publican. Is a publican, where they're hitting him with the cues. But and then Sean shouts out to die, kill the queen. The German guys doing the translation thought, I think they changed it to something like kill the gays or something.
Oh
like
my
they,
God.
They fundamentally misunderstood what he's like. No, because it's the band. And the joke is that the queen, we're English. We love and revere the queen.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that would not have gone
that's
well.
That's a tough translation.
Yeah.
Okay. Next up. Todo mundo quase morto, which translates as everybody almost dead.
Todo mundo quase morto?
Yes.
Is that Spanish? I'm just going to say Spanish every time.
So that's Portuguese also, but it's the Brazilian release.
Brazilian Portuguese.
Yes.
Okay. And again, what was the translated title?
Everybody Almost Dead.
Everybody Almost Dead. That's not bad.
It's not bad.
No.
The next one. This one, I'm interested to see what you're going to say.
Okay.
Sean et les Zombies.
Well, that
E-T-L-E-S,
Zombies. That's French, right? That's got to be French.
It is French language, but this is the...
Is it French Canadian?
It's French Canadian.
The Quebecois release.
That's right. In France, it got released with the English title, Shaun of the Dead.
Interesting.
Weird. I don't know.
Well, it's Europe. They all speak English.
And the last one, which is the one that you heard me clicking the Google Translate one on earlier, because I really needed help with the pronunciation.
Okay.
Is Sumrak Mirfish, which translates as Twilight of the Dead.
Is that like Icelandic somehow? And is it, what do you call that? The
hint, Eastern Europe, not Northern.
It's like, I don't know, like Czech or something?
Nailed
is it
Czech.
Really?
It's Czech.
Czechoslovakian. And what is the title again?
Sumrak Mirtvich, which translates as Twilight of the Dead.
Twilight of the Dead.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Twilight of the Dead's not bad. But it doesn't communicate
anything at all.
It doesn't tell you anything about the movie.
I mean, it just sounds like the next installment in the Romero ones.
Yeah.
I like Everybody Almost Dead.
Everybody Almost Dead is pretty good. Yeah, and you know, language. Language is difficult. Language doesn't translate everywhere, especially jokes.
Jokes are really hard.
Not crossover.
So yeah, I had a really, really hard time with bad reviews of this movie. Everybody loves it.
There's no bad even user reviews.
There are a couple. Most of them are unusable for this segment because they go into like really nitpicky.
There's no guessing. It's all zombie minutia and shit like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One that I really loved had a great title and it went on to be really rambly and navel-gazy and annoying. But the title of this review on IMDb was Yawn of the Dead.
It's pretty good.
It's pretty good, right?
That's pretty good.
And then another honorable mention was, speaking of language, this movie is not in English. It's in a thick dialect that only a pub dweller could understand. How can a movie be funny when you have to read subtitles?
Okay, so that's pretty good. But also, I don't think anybody in this movie has a dense accent to navigate.
It's very easy to understand.
It's not like... I don't know, like some of the 90s and early aughts, like British gangster movies, like where I just kept having to turn the fucking subtitles on because the density of those like particular British accents.
And it's funny that in Hot Fuzz, they go on to do a joke about exactly that, where they have a double translator situation for the farmer.
Yeah. God, what is that guy's name? The farmer's so funny.
He's so funny. Do you have a permit for that? Does for this one. I do for this one.
These are good movies. I really want him to do another Peg Frost movie, like just purely selfishly because I love that special vibe from the three of them, but also because two of Edgar's three non Cornetto trilogy movies I'm not super nutso butso about.
Yeah.
I didn't
love Last Night in Soho.
I really didn't like Last Night in Soho. And Baby Driver, I like Baby Driver a lot, but it's not like...
It's not insta classic the way the rest are.
Well, no. And, you know, part of the problem is fucking Ansel Elgort is, in addition to being apparently like a rapist...
What?
Oh, yeah. He's canceled.
Okay.
Yeah, I think West Side Story will be the end for him. And then we will not see him anymore.
Good. We'll... Yeah. Love to hear it.
But anyway, yeah, I want more of that special flavor because I think the magic of those three movies is the fusion of their sensibilities and in particular Peg and Wright as writers together.
Right.
Like, and then Wright elevating that with his own particular like style and formalism. I would love to see more of that and less self-indulgent nonsense like Last Night in Soho.
Tell us what you really feel, Scott.
Well, I don't know, Jamie. I just don't know that like Edgar Wright was maybe the guy who needed to come in and tell a story about how show business is exploitive and of women in particular. is Edgar really the guy? Oh, and then spoilers for the movie at the end. It turns out that
oh, good.
Not a good look, Edgar.
That's a bad fucking look. hate that.
Oh boy, wasn't that great? Wasn't that good stuff? Jamie, did you enjoy all of that? Future Jamie?
I mean, past Jamie also loved it.
That's true.
It's Shaun of the Dead, for fuck's sake.
Right. It's wonderful. And we talked a lot and we had lots of laughs and good times. I'm Future Scott. That's Future Jamie. This is several weeks after we recorded that episode. Our episodes lately have been real long, so like we've done the last couple of times, we're going to split this up. Another two-parter. I've heard one bit of anecdotal evidence that one person likes the two-parters. If you do or do not, please let us know. Send us an email, and then we'll know if you don't want us to do this anymore. But we're doing it now, damn it.
And we will blame that one point of information that we have.
That's right.
For our lack of judgment.
That's right. Johnny Words is to blame for this trend that he only voiced an opinion on now. But so we're donezo for today. Thanks for tuning in for us talking about Shaun of the Dead. Come back in 1 week. And Jamie, what are we talking about next time?
Next time, we're talking about Fred Leume, Grüne Weltliner from the Kamptal, yeah?
If you thought that German accent was bad or offensive, please feel free to let us know at Bigger Bottle Pod, anywhere that you can send direct messages.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Please follow us on the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod. If you have comments, concerns, if you think that my impression of an Austrian man was bad, you can email us at biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Make sure you rate, review, and follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to tell your fucking friends about us.
Tell your friends and rate the show on Spotify. We know a lot of you guys are Spotify listeners. Please go in, give us a, 4 to 5 star rating, whichever feels truer to your heart. This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That is me. Our social media presence is thanks to the fine work of Jamie Harrison Rubin. That's him right over there, virtually across from me.
Remember, everyone, drink more wine and watch more movies. It's good for you. We promise.
We do promise. And also, remember, Jamie, dogs can look up.
You're goddamn right, dogs can look up.
Dogs can look up!